WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
You're a good man, Charlie Brown. You're good at what you do, too.
She is Natalie Jacobson.
You are the dean of South Shore Broadcasters.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
Best-selling author, Dave Wedge. You got to say that.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mayor. Yes. Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Kevin, it's been a long time. Thanks for all you do. All you know, your local news icon. We appreciate it.
Kathy's doing a great job at this. And I've decided she's jelly. I got to be peanut butter.
There was a debate about that.
You fine with jelly?
I'm fine with jelly.
Okay, good. Jelly spikes my sugars.
Good evening and welcome to Monday Night Talk. As you know, I am not Kevin Tachi, and I'm going to be your host for the first hour.
Massachusetts State Auditor Diana DeZoglio, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
It's great to be back. Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.
Jermaine Wiggins, member of the 2001 Super Bowl champion New England Patriots. Welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Oh, thank you for having me. Anytime.
Not just economic development, but it's how to get the businesses involved.
Senator, I want to thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you being a voice bringing so much community news to folks here on the South Shore.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening to Monday Night Talk, coming to you from the newly renovated studios here at 95.9 WATD, live from Broadcast House. My name is Kevin Tachi, and what we do here every Monday night is try to provide you with good conversation, things that are going on in and around our communities and beyond. And sometimes we have some fun book authors and folks who are experts in certain fields. Tonight is no different. In a couple of moments, we are going to speak with Mr. Greg Eaton. Greg is the chairman of the Whitman Republican Town Committee, also the co-host of the Right Massachusetts podcast. And we can talk about what's going on with the Republican the party here in the Great Commonwealth and some of the races that are up for grabs. And, you know, is there a chance for the GOP to reclaim some of the seats in the House of Representatives and in the Senate? Following that, we have the State House Report, a staple of this radio program. We have joining us this evening, we are going to speak with State Senator John Keenan. We'll kind of get a chance to talk with him about last Thursday's 40-0 vote on the bill that he had been sponsoring. In regards to revenge porn. Also going to talk a little bit about there's an ongoing effort to have safe sites for folks to be able to use drugs. So, in fact, that there's someone there so they don't end up overdosing. We're going to talk a little bit about that. And then we will turn our focus to hour number two, another issue that is many communities are dealing with, depending on where they are in the process, the MBTA communities law. And I have someone who's going to be joining us, as well as a town planner, Judy Barrett, founder of Barrett Planning Group, LLC, with 35-plus years of experience when it comes to community planning, affordable housing, economic development, along with Abington town planner Liz Shea. They're going to provide insight. I'm sure folks have heard the latest going on with Milton, where the town meeting decided to approve their plan for the MBTA communities law, and then a vote overturned that. And now there's ramifications. The Attorney General is involved. We're going to talk about where things are, get a better understanding of it from Judy, and also a community that's getting ready to vote for their plan in Abington next Monday night as they have town meeting. So that ought to be interesting. And then we'll close things out on a strong note. Jerry Thornton, writer with BarstoolSports.com. We'll talk a little New England Patriots. What have they done during the offseason? New coach. And have you had a chance to see Apple TV's docuseries, The Dynasty? Well, we're going to get Jerry's thought on it. Jerry is a devout, not only is he a writer, but he's also someone who's very passionate about the New England Patriots. So it is going to make for some great conversation throughout the evening. Now, we'll bring in out of the bullpen as he runs, and I don't know what his song would be as if he's running in to take the hill. But we have Mr. Greg Eaton, who is joining us. Greg, how are you this evening, sir?
Kevin, it is great to be with you. It's great to be with the listeners of Monday Night Talk, and I'm always happy to be on WATD. So I'm looking forward to a good conversation.
Good. Well, for folks who don't know, you actually co-host a podcast with Mr. Tom Joyce, who we can hear every Wednesday night on the JV team. What exactly is the Right Massachusetts podcast about?
So the Right Massachusetts podcast first focuses primarily on issues that have to do with the right side of the aisle, as far as politics go and as far as what's going on at the State House. Admittedly, we haven't put out an episode in a little while. It is slow going when there are no races going on. It's a non-election year. But you might be giving me the extra push to get out there and put some episodes together as, it's an election year and there's some interesting races here. So you might be giving me the extra push to get back into the groove.
Yeah, let me throw a little fodder out at you, and that is here we are post-state committee elections. Where do things stand right now with the Republican Party in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
You know, I think the Peter Durant race, he won a state Senate race, and then the Republican Party was able to hold on to his seat in the state House, both out in Worcester County, says that the Republican Party is on the uptick here. I'm optimistic about those victories, and I think the rest of the party and the rest of the party leadership is optimistic about those victories. And, we're seeing kind of nationwide that we may have pushed too far to one side of the political agenda, and the natural regression there is to swing back the other way a bit. And so I think that 2024 is going to be a good year for the Republican Party, both in the state of Massachusetts and nationwide.
The one thing I've never understood in regards to the Republican Party, it's the minority party here in the state, is that there's not enough, how can I say it? I don't want to use kumbaya, but there's not enough teamwork that's going on. It seems like there's always been, for the past 10 years, a degree of infighting. And that's, to kind of bolster my thought here is, recently, as of today, that former Mass GOP chair Jim Lyons has actually started his own party, the Freedom Fighters. And so, this is somebody who, is a strong voice, but not everybody can play in the sandbox together.
Yeah, that's definitely true that the Republican Party seems to have had issues with everyone trying to row the boat in the same direction. Those issues predate my involvement with the party. In all honesty, they predate me being alive. It's funny, when I was doing the Right Massachusetts podcast and during the last chairman's race, I reached out to one of the old chairs who was the chair back in the 80s, and he's now a professor at Texas A&M, I believe. And one of the things that he kind of said to me as I was looking into what happened when he was in charge of it and the discourse that was going on then, he was like, yeah, time's kind of a flat circle. The same fights that we were fighting in the 80s are still the same fights that we're fighting now. The thing is that winning seems to solve everything. So I think that it's easy for people to try and have ideas and try and push the boat one way or the other way when the Republican Party is not winning races. It's easy for lots of people to say that they have the solution to the problem. Winning solves everything. If we can get out there and we can start winning some races, then suddenly people might be more willing to row the boat in the same direction.
But you're even seeing conservative talk show hosts. I'm not going to mention any names, but you're having conservative talk show hosts who are going at it, and even former U.S. Senate and gubernatorial candidates saber-rattling in regards to, and name-calling. And I'm just curious what good it's going to do if, in fact, because the biggest problem here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is that, you know, that there is a definitely it's lopsided when it comes to representation. And I think that the public, the taxpayer, is best served when there is a little bit of equality. While it may be, it's going to be years before we see that, you know, at least when you had Charlie Baker in office, at least you had him in the executive office, and that provided a little bit of balance. But now it's completely lopsided.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my overall thesis on what would be a good plan for the Republican Party has always been to focus on the lower level seats. We should be focused on state rep seats, and we should be focused on state senate seats. Without having a veto-proof minority, having the governorship is, although great in one sense, it's basically a token prize. And so, to me, the thing that the Republican Party should be focused on is getting 15 state senators or getting 54 state representatives. And that way, the Republican Party actually has a seat at the table. Because right now, the way that it's presently constituted, the Democratic Party has a veto-proof majority, and they can go around any veto that a governor lays down. So the only real veto that we have in the state when the Republican Party is in control of the governorship is the pocket veto.
Well, and again, it's worth noting, and folks going, oh, Tachi's talking about Republicans. I'm unenrolled. I am super neutral. But, you know, I think it's in the best interest of everybody that there should be some kind of, you know, it should be, it'll never be even, Stephen, let's be honest here. But I feel that if there's an equal amount of voices or somewhat close to that, I mean, even if you had 65-35, that at least there's good conversation, and it's not just a rubber stamp when it comes to passing legislation, when it comes to talking about the Commonwealth's finances. I think that's important, and I think a lot of other people would say that as well. Again, I do not carry water for either side. I love having conversations with individuals, whether they are a Democrat, a Republican, or other, you know, and I think that's important.
Monday Night Talk has always been kind of a safe space for both sides of the political aisle, and it's a good place for political discourse, to tell you the truth. So, I mean, it's a good place to hear opinions from both sides of the aisle, and you don't think twice about having one member of a party on versus another member of the opposition party. So, in a lot of ways, your show works the way that our state legislature is supposed to work. But as you've pointed out, with the reduced number of Republican voices in the House and Senate, it is hard for our political discourse to work the way that it's supposed to in this state.
Now, I'm not sure how much what you have in front of you as far as for information in regards across the state of Massachusetts when it comes to a lot of the state representative and state Senate races. I know here on the South Shore, we're seeing a lot of turnover. We're seeing a lot of seats that are up for grabs. But you're also seeing Republicans like Matt Muratori, who, first Plymouth District state rep, looking to run for, you know, state Senate. Anthony D'Amelia, he is stepping away from his state rep seat. You're seeing Josh Cutler, a Democrat, he's stepping away after a long time. You're seeing a lot of folks who are, you know, a lot of moving pieces. Dylan Fernandez is running for that open that seat that Sue Moran is not going to seek another term for. You got a lot of moving parts here. Give me your thoughts as to is this the same across the Commonwealth? Have you observed this, or is this something that you need to do a little homework on?
No, you are 100% correct. We are seeing a lot of state legislators that are deciding to not run for election across the board, across the state. You've highlighted several key races here on the South Shore that I have my eyes on. Definitely Ken Sweezy and Jan Cornith are running a primary in the 6th Plymouth. That is a race I'm very interested in. That's a seat that the Republican Party, I think, could have a good chance of winning, no matter who the candidate is that comes out of that primary. I would think that they would have a good shot to win in that seat. Ken Sweezy ran last time around, performed pretty well, and now that Josh Cutler has decided not to run for re-election and has vacated his seat, I would think that would be a strong Republican chance to flip a seat. In the state Senate, Matt Moratori is running a primary against Kerry McRae.
Yep.
That's a state Senate seat that was previously held by the Republican Party. State Senator Vinny DiMaceo had that seat for about 10 years before deciding to retire from the state legislature. Another seat that I think Republican Party could have a say about who's going to be representing that district is the Mark Pacheco seat over in the Taunton area.
Oh, sure.
And that stretches all the way down into the Wareham area. There's a couple of interesting seats down that South Coast area that I think are chances that the Republican Party could win a few seats. So we are definitely seeing a big turnover as far as the amount of state legislators that are deciding not to run for re-election or running for different offices. Also of interest, I think that the Dee Wallace campaign, who is running to take over that seat that Matt Moratori is vacating, I think that is an interesting campaign from a Republican standpoint, and I think that she is a great candidate.
If there are going to be primary races on the Republican side of things, are we seeing candidates that are primarily pro-Trump or not so much Trump? Is that what we're seeing with a lot of these races?
So I don't think that state politics really comes down to that.
Okay.
You know, I know that that's like an area that a lot of people like to point to as like the differences between the between Republicans. To me, that doesn't really matter. I think what really matters is what you're going to do when you're in the state house and how you plan on working with your constituents and working with the rest of the house in order to get things passed and to make sure that the Republican Party has a strong and boisterous voice on Beacon Hill as the minority party. We can't be taking a back seat like we have been for the last 25 years on opposing things that are bad for the Commonwealth.
Again, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Greg Eaton. He is the chairman of the Whitman Republican Town Committee, also a co-host of the Right Massachusetts podcast that he teams up with the mighty Tom Joyce on a regular basis. He's already admitted that there's a little bit of a hiatus, but that there's something in the works for new material. Looking at, you know, the presidential race, do you feel that that's going to play a big role down ticket, depending on how Trump does here in the Commonwealth?
So how Trump does in the Commonwealth, I don't think will have a huge effect on whether or not Republicans down ballot can make their voices heard and, you know, get their vote out. I think that you've seen in years past that although presidential tight years are tough for Republican candidates to win, you've seen years past that people have been able to split their state rep vote away from what they do nationally. And we have Republican representatives win in districts where where the Republican candidate doesn't do well. Obviously, Donald Trump is probably going to be our nominee, as I believe everyone else has dropped out of the race at this point. So Donald Trump looks like he is most likely going to be the Republican nominee, barring some kind of shenanigans at the nominating convention.
Now, Whitman is fortunate because you have State Representative Allison Sullivan Almeida, and she is fast becoming a leader in the House. But how often are you having conversations with some of the other RTCs where there's an open seat and they have a candidate who, you know, they're hoping to have a candidate or field a candidate to run for an open seat? And we haven't mentioned Brockton has Jerry Cassidy. He's no longer running for that seat. But do Republicans even exist in Brockton?
I mean, the Brockton Republican Town Committee is formed, and they meet fairly regularly from what I understand. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that the Republicans have a stronghold in Brockton in Brockton at all,
right.
But I will say that there is actually a couple of elected Republicans on the city council for the first time in years, and I believe that there's a couple of Republicans even on the school committee in Brockton. So I think that you are seeing a slow uptick in the ability for Republicans to win in Brockton.
How important is it, you know, you talk about the lower levels count, Well, I know that it's nonpartisan when it comes to select boards and city councils, but I mean, how important is it to at least get Republicans to be elected on the municipal level, and then at least they're building themselves a little bit of a portfolio to run for a higher seat?
You've hit the nail on the head. These lower level seats are important because it basically becomes a bench for candidates to move up if they want to move up. You know, obviously serving in these roles is very important to every one of these towns, and to view them as a stepping stone is a huge issue. And it's an issue that I take wholeheartedly when I'm talking to candidates about, you know, whether or not they want to move up and whether or not they have aspirations to run for other things. That being said, being on these local boards is a great way to prove yourself as a leader, to prove yourself as a person who can legislate and a person who can solve problems. And so without a doubt, I think that running for a smaller seat, whether it's school committee, whether it's selectmen or, you know, city council or, you know, even planning board, all of those important functions of local government are very important to understand if you're going to run for a higher seat. So having that local municipal experience and winning races is paramount. And it's one of the things that Republican town chairs, that's their primary function, is to help local candidates get elected to office.
So I'm going to throw it out that you had mentioned Mark Pacheco. Senator Mark Pacheco is not seeking re-election. Am I correct? Is it Kelly Dooner is a Taunton city councilor who is running for that seat, or is it someone else?
So Kelly Dooner is currently running. She is the Taunton City Council president.
Yep.
I don't believe that there are any other announced candidates from the Republican side. I believe that there is a Democrat, but I do not know who it is.
How much does it help? And I'm just going to throw this out there. I mean, being, you know, the president of the council in Taunton, and let's not forget you have a Republican in Mayor Sean O'Connell, who I think this weekend just had her inauguration ball at the Gillette Stadium. But how does that help a candidate when you have someone like O'Connell who can help the candidate and get the word out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that having mayorships is super important. And once again, that's one of those things where it helps the Republican Party prove that we can do the job. Having effective leaders that can, you know, lead city government and prove that the Republican Party can do the job and can be the leaders that we say we can be is paramount to the credibility of other candidates. And so that speaks a little bit to Kelly's campaign. You know, she's kind of followed in the footsteps a little bit of Shauna here. And as the city council president, I think that she has proven herself to be attentive to her constituents' needs and has a deep understanding of budgets and other things that are paramount to running the city of Taunton. And now she wants to take those skills that she's developed and she wants to represent a state Senate district and be able to go to the state Senate and make the argument for more funding for her constituents and for her cities and towns.
Well, I'm sure State Senator Patrick O'Connell is looking forward to hopefully having some reinforcements in the Senate chamber come January 1 of 2025.
Yeah, I mean, those are two important state Senate races. Yep. And I think that the likelihood that we can win one or both of them as the Republican Party is pretty high.
So as we get ready to close out our segment here, and I definitely thank you, and that is there any dark horse races you're watching, whether it's not necessarily here locally, but ones that bear watching around the Commonwealth that might be just beyond our reach?
That is an interesting question, Kevin, and I hadn't really put any thought into it. I will tell you that local municipal elections are around the corner.
Yep.
And those are super important races. So do your homework on your candidates and, you know, take a real good look at who you vote for selectmen and who you vote for school committee in your town and communities. I say it all the time when I get asked about presidential politics. The most important votes that you make are the ones that make decisions closest to you. And so that's your selectmen, that's your school committee, that's your planning board. Those people have a far bigger impact on your life than the president ever will. And so a lot of people get fired up about voting for the president, and they only vote for the big elections. The truth is that you should be focused, laser focused, on the municipal elections, because those people make decisions that affect your day-to-day life every day.
Indeed. And if folks want to be able to stay on top of your latest podcast when you produce them, how can they do that?
You can find us on all the major podcasting platforms. All you have to do is type in Right Massachusetts, and we should pop up. And Greg, you can take a listen to some of our old interviews. We had some great interviews last cycle and going into last year. So take a listen to those, too.
Excellent. Well, we'll have you back on at some point to talk a little bit about where things stand with the Republican Party.
Sounds good.
All right, there he is. Greg Eaton, our guest for your opening segment of Monday Night Talk, and talking about podcasts. All of our podcasts are up to date for Monday Night Talk. Just go to the homepage of 95.9 WATD and look under podcast. We'll be back in just a moment with the State Hour Report with John Keenan. Stay tuned.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Eat, drink, and socialize at the patio at McWiggins in Whitman Center. Sit down with a specialty cocktail and start your meal off with a patio sampler with chicken wings, egg rolls, potato skins, fried cauliflower, and chicken and biscuits. Watch the game on 7 55-inch monitors while digging into braised short ribs, fish tacos, pig and goat cheese flatbread, or Koji steak tips. Relax and listen to the live entertainment at the patio every Friday and Saturday night. And don't forget, McWiggins Pub next door. They're located at 546 and 552 Washington Street in downtown Whitman.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. People ask me, is there anything they can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
Is there anything I can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
See? There is. Those big gravel trucks, when they're being loaded, rocks get stuck in the framework of the bed. Truck hits a bump, rock hits your windshield. It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk.
And the conversation continues right here on Monday Night Talk, 95.9 WATD. And this segment is the State House Report. Of course, joining us on a regular basis is none other than State Senator John Keenan, as he joins us. Senator, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. I think right out of the gate, I want to congratulate you on last week's unanimous support for a piece of legislation that I know that you have been working to get recognized, and that is the revenge porn legislation, as it passed the Senate last week. What was that like to have that piece of legislation at least clear your part of the state Senate, and now move on to the conference committee?
Yeah, we were thrilled to see it pass. We came close last session. Last session it passed the House, and then had passed the Senate on an informal vote, meaning it wasn't a roll call vote. And it just wasn't enough time to iron out the relatively minor differences between the House version and the Senate version. And so the bill was refiled this year, and I think in a better form. It passed the House unanimously. It came over to the Senate, and we were able to move it to the Senate floor pretty quickly. And so it was great to get it passed. It will now go to a conference committee to iron out the differences that still remain between the two bills. But I'm very optimistic that will be done pretty easily, and then we'll be able to move the bill to the governor's desk.
Well, what do you think? It sounds to me as though there might be a few minor differences between the House and Senate version. You feel that this could be something that is remediated pretty quick?
I think so. One of the bigger differences is that we create, and the House created in their bill as well, a diversion program for young people who may be engaged in this activity. They'd go to court, and then rather than go through the judicial system, they would be diverted to an educational program. and the curriculum for that educational program in the House version would be created by the Attorney General's office. The curriculum for that program in the Senate version of the bill would be created by the Office of the Child Advocate. And so there's agreement on the diversion program, on creating a curriculum for the diversion program, on what that curriculum should contain and address. It's just a disagreement as to who, which entity would be best to develop it.
So it sounds like there'll be maybe a few days of conversation and maybe something in short order. At least we're all crossing our fingers and hoping.
Yes. So it'll take a little bit of time for the conference committee to be formed. And then once it's formed, it'll meet. And sometimes because of scheduling, those meetings take a little bit of time if there's more than one to schedule and to actually have the meeting. But I do think that the differences are relatively small. The Senate added another provision. You know, the bill contains obviously the revenge porn language, but it also addresses the issue of coercive control in a relationship. Our abuse statutes have not included that in the past. So when you have somebody who threatens an individual to shut those individuals off from family members, to control their finances, to control their social media, to put tracking devices on their cars, all the types of things that are abusive, but not necessarily physically abusive. This bill addresses that topic as well. And it addresses it through the form of a change in the 209A, which is the restraining order statute. And the Senate also added changes to Chapter 258E, which is an harassment protection order section of the general laws. And the House hadn't included that in theirs, but we're hopeful that they'll agree to it during conference committee. And if not, we'll find common ground nonetheless. And again, hopefully report the bill pretty quickly.
Well, we'll keep an eye on this and see how it proceeds, and hopefully eventually it'll be on the governor's desk for a signature and for it to be put in the law. Now, if this is something that is done, you know, we're doing this early enough in the second half of the legislative session, when would this, if this is signed into law, when does this go into effect? Does it go into effect as of January 1 of 25?
That's still to be determined. Generally, the bills can have an emergency preamble attached that might make them effective immediately.
Okay.
That can sometimes occur. So that's still to be worked out. But I can just touch on one other thing that the bill does.
Please do.
We were 48 other states have legislation like this as it relates to revenge porn. So we will catch up with the 48 other states in that respect. We address the issue of coercive control, which is something that other states have done and still others are looking at. And one of the unique things that we've done in this bill that only a few other states have done is that we address the issue of deep fakes. And the idea is that somebody consents to an image being taken, a nude image, partially nude image, or an image showing somebody in sexual conduct, and that image is shared without consent in 48 other states. That's illegal. It will, when this bill passes, be illegal in Massachusetts. But what we realized in doing this is that with technology the way it is, somebody can basically cause the same harm in the same way with the same intent by taking an image of somebody and altering it to make it look like they are nude, partially nude, or engaged in sexual conduct. They're doing it for the same reasons, in the same way, with the same result. And so our bill addresses that. We call it digitization of images. And so our bill addresses that. A few other states have done it. We'll be one of the early states to do that, again, if the bill comes out of conference committee and goes to the governor's desk.
Well, we'll follow this as it trends towards the right direction. Like I said, the governor's desk, which hopefully will be sooner than later. Again, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with State Senator John Keenan, and he's joining us for the State House report. I want to turn our attention to gambling. This is an industry that is growing. It's blossoming here in the Commonwealth since it's been signed into law. But what comes the good and the financial arm of it to be able to help communities and you know, generate revenue, it's also causing a negative effect, and that is addiction. And I know that you have mentioned whether it's on social media or otherwise, that this is becoming a public health crisis in the state.
It is. We are seeing the number of calls to the gambling helpline skyrocketing. We are hearing more and more about the negative impacts of sports betting on individuals and then the related issues and impacts on family and on work. We're hearing more and more of that. And as we've researched this more and gotten more engaged in the process as to how this is happening, so much of it is occurring because of the big push by the sports betting industry through advertising. And we believe that advertising to be false, deceptive, misleading. You see the ads on TV all the time. Bet $5, get $500. What you're really getting is credits that are designed to keep you betting. And when you run through those credits in relatively short order, then they feel like they've got you in a position where you will start using your own money to bet. So we've been looking closely at the advertising. And, you know, just as an example, and I'm sorry, beyond advertising, just what the industry is doing in terms of, for instance, real-time betting. It used to be that people would bet on a spread on a basketball game or a football game, who's going to win and by how many points. What the sports betting industry is doing now is that when somebody has bet on the spread and it looks like they're losing, they basically target individuals for in-game betting opportunities. Okay, you think you're going to lose because the spread isn't going your way, so you double down and think, oh, I'll bet on whether this kicker kicks the field goal. I'll bet on whether the Celtics' next basket is a three-pointer. I'll bet on whether a player is going to score more than 25 points, even though there's only 5 minutes left in the game. And those are really the addictive bets. Those are the ones that really get people to the point where they become addicted. They're doubling down. They're trying to get back the money that they maybe lost in the spread. And as an example, I was watching the Celtics game the other night, and during the game, on the upper left-hand corner of the screen, they had the spread and information about that. And the broadcaster of the game said, oh, I don't know if that'll hold because I think the other team has one more run left than them. So you have an opportunity for an in-game bet, and a broadcaster is telling you, hey, it's a pretty good chance this other team's going to score more points and narrow that spread. Sending the message, basically, not explicitly, but implicitly, here's a chance to make a bet, and I'm giving you some advice on it. And it's just so tempting, and it's all designed to draw the bettors in. So there's all kinds of that conduct going on, and we're going to take a real good, and we are taking a real good hard look at how to protect people from what's happening. This industry is just out to make a lot of money.
And so that isn't, the problems that you've pointed out aren't enough. I believe that Governor Healey is actually considering cuts to the state's main fund for combating gambling addiction. I don't know if this is because of trying to fund the migrant issue or because of shortfalls in revenue benchmarks that aren't being met. What are your thoughts on that? And what are your concerns? Is there any thought to have that for conversations to be had with the governor to ask her to reconsider?
Yeah. So, it is, I think, an effort to balance the budget.
Yep.
Not an awful lot of money, but nonetheless, we are finding ourselves, as you mentioned, in a situation where our revenues are not meeting benchmarks. And that appears to be the case as we go into the next fiscal year, which is where she, the budget for which she, that's where she put this cut. So I do think it's an attempt to kind of balance out the budget. And her explanation is that there's money already in that account and that we're not cutting the account, we're just not putting in additional money that may or may not be needed in the upcoming fiscal year. My feeling is that this is a really burgeoning public health crisis and we need as many resources as we possibly can to fully address it. And now is not the time in any way to cut back on that funding. The industry is making a lot of money. Their profits are rising. The state is taking in more revenue from this. And while both of those things occurring, it is an effort to draw back on our commitment to help people who have gambling issues. And so I don't think it's the right time. We're looking to address that in the Senate version of the budget and to make sure that the resources are available to help people and to prevent people from going down the path towards gambling addiction. And no problem with people going to a casino or sports betting in a responsible way for entertainment. But we know that a certain percentage of people who engage in the activity will become addicted. And we know from studies out of New Jersey and recent study out of Connecticut that the vast majority of the money made by the betting industry is made off of those who are problem gamblers.
So what can be done when it comes to folks who are facing gambling addiction? I know that the legislation is already, has been enacted. Can there be any amendments? I would believe that before this was something that was approved by the House and the Senate and signed into law by the governor, that there were some provisions to help folks who are, that the gaming industry, online specifically, would, put money into a fund or find ways to help folks who are dealing with gambling addiction. You see so many ads for, how you can, you've already mentioned them, DraftKings and how you can do in-game parlays and stuff like that. Would there not be a way to maybe have it where you can amend any of this legislation for them to put money into public service announcements that, for every two advertisements we see, that they also have to fund an expense, a public service announcement about if you need help with gambling addiction, other than doing a 5-second blurb as they're closing out the said ad?
You raise a great point, and that's something that we're looking at. We're looking at a few things. One is to have the Gaming Commission enforce the regulations that are in place right now in terms of what can be advertised. You mentioned parlays. My view, as I review the regulations, is that they are not permitted to be contained in an advertisement because they are encouraging a specific type of bet. So we're asking the Gaming Commission to pay more attention to this. We also have filed legislation to prohibit false, deceptive, or misleading advertising. Things that, for instance, say, you can no sweat betting, guarantee bet, those types of things, because nothing is guaranteed, and betting, ultimately the house wins. We're looking to do that. We're considering options relative to in-game betting. And also the funding to make sure that the types of things that you mentioned, advertising and outreach and prevention efforts, as well as treatment efforts, are in place. What you mentioned about a certain amount of advertising to advise people of where to get help or the dangers of betting for every two that the industry may do, that was utilized in the tobacco advertising debate many, many years ago at the national level. And what the tobacco industry found was that the counter ads were so effective, and because they were tied to how many ads the industry would do, the industry agreed essentially with a little bit of push to stop advertising. They found the counter ads so effective that they basically said, for every two, three, four, or five that we do, they're one, highlighting the dangers of tobacco, were more effective. And so they walked away with a push from advertising. And so it shows that type of advertising, advising people of dangers, can be very effective. And so we're looking at that as well.
Again, we got a couple of moments left with State Senator John Kenan. Probably the last thing, we just got two or three minutes left, but I want to give you an opportunity to talk about something that is being discussed. I don't know if this is something that is I don't know how it would be able to be allowed, if it's something that legislation has to be passed or it's just a discussion, supervised drug consumption sites in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I believe that there are other states that do this. Have you had a chance to kind of review this and look at it?
I have. Over the last few years, on my own, not as part of any official trips, I have in some cases gotten in my car, in another case flown out to a city. I have visited safe consumption sites in Montreal, in Quebec City, in Toronto, and in Vancouver. And then also the one that recently opened in New York City. I basically have done those, as I say, on my own, visited these sites, stood outside them during the course of the day, sometimes as late as 2 a.m, watching the comings and goings, making observational notes. I recently wrote an opinion piece for the Boston Globe on it. my thought is this. We continue to have an increasing number of people dying from opioid overdoses. And these facilities throughout the world and in North America, up in Canada, and now in New York, have proven to be very effective. The concern is to make sure that they are properly located, properly managed, and that, you know, there is buy-in from the community. So there's legislation now in both the House and the Senate that would allow a community that chooses to open one to have the liability protections in place so that they could proceed. It's not a mandate that any community open them. It's not a requirement that the state go in and open them. It leaves it entirely up to a community. And there are a couple communities in Massachusetts who have expressed an interest. The Worcester Department of Public Health recently voted to authorize or start the process of opening a safe consumption site and overdose prevention center in Worcester. There's still a long way to go. They would need state legislation, again, to address liability issues. But they are interested and are choosing to do it. The city of Somerville has expended a great amount of effort in researching the possibility of opening one there. And so if they want to open them as part of a pilot program, I think they should be able to. But again, they have to be carefully managed, properly located, and make sure that there's community acceptance of them before they open. And so it's a really interesting concept for Massachusetts, but it has been done all over the world. Nobody's ever died in one of these facilities anywhere in the world. They prove to help people in an overdose situation prevent death. They save money because you're not having ambulance, police, and fire calls and people transported to emergency departments. And so it's something that we should certainly look at. And if the community wants to do it as part of a pilot program, then consider that as well.
It's like a situation that bears watching and that you and I will have to do an update on when there's more information. Senator, if any of your constituents want to reach out to you, speak to your fantastic staff, or just want to, you know, say hi to you, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can call the office at 617-722-1494, or they can send an email to john.keenan@masenate.gov. And if they call, they will, you know, between normal business hours, there'll be always somebody that's there to pick up the phone. And we try to be as responsible as possible to email. So we urge anybody with a question or concern to call us. And then also we regularly do office hours in the communities, at the libraries, at the senior centers, at town halls. And so we have on our website, that information is out there. So if they, and we try to put it in local newspapers as well. If they see that there's an office hour scheduled, feel free to drop by and bring up the concern and have a chat.
Well, we want to thank you again for always being at the ready whenever Monday Night Talk reaches out and asks you to be a part of the show to kind of give an update as to some of the things going on up at the State House or in and around your district.
The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. 95.9 WATD FM Marshfield.
This is the CBS World News Roundup Late Edition. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
By the middle of the week, so much news has come your way, you need your own team to sort it out. Lucky for you, there's Jared Valenzuela and the JV team to talk about the things you've heard and catch you up on some things you might not know.
I'm Jared Valenzuela. Join me and my guests as we have fun with current events and try to put things into perspective each week. Sponsored by Corey Welch of Boom Realty. Catch the JV team every Wednesday night at 6:15 here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We return for hour number two of Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. A quick tip of the cap to our sponsors, McGuigan's Pub and the patio at McGuigan's in Whitman. Also, Tiny & Sons Glass, proud sponsors of Monday Night Talk. Quick note, later this hour, we will speak with Jerry Thornton. Jerry with BarstoolSports.com. Talk a little New England Patriots and even delve into the mini documentary, The Dynasty. But first, we're going to talk a little Massachusetts Communities Law And joining us for this segment, we have Abington Town Planner, Liz Shea. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Kevin.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
And also owner and managing director of Barrett Planning Group, LLC. We have Judy Barrett. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
These two folks, they are very well known when it comes to dealing with the Massachusetts Communities Law, which was adopted by our very own Commonwealth in 2021. And the problem here is that there are communities who have the commuter rail that may run through it, or they may be in a neighboring community that have to deal with this because they are expected to make some changes when it comes to zoning to add additional housing. As you may or may not know, that the housing stock is a big problem here in Massachusetts. We'll start with Judy. Judy, who is actually, you've got 35 years experience when it comes to planning, community development. You're a consultant, someone who also specializes in economic development when it comes to state and local. If you could, kind of give us the Cliff's Notes version of the Massachusetts community law and the consultant that you do for communities who seek your services.
Certainly. So the MBTA Communities Law is part of the housing choice legislation that passed in 2021. The housing choice legislation includes two parts. One is the MBTA Communities Law, and the other is it makes it a little easier for communities to adopt zoning changes to promote multifamily housing or allow accessory dwelling units, or to allow mixed-use development. So the MBTA communities piece is what applies to 177 cities and towns, roughly between Boston and Worcester, places where there are train stations, rapid transit, ferry service, or communities that are adjacent to those towns. And they have staggered deadlines to comply, to change their zoning, to allow multifamily housing at a density of at least 15 units an acre, near public transit where that's possible, or in other locations that would make sense, such as downtown centers.
It sounds like you just answered my question, because I was going to ask is, what exactly is the window of time? It sounds as though it's like a sliding scale, depending on a respective community's their charter, and maybe when they might have town meeting, or they may make certain decisions fiscally that they may need to adopt this.
So the deadlines actually started last year with the so-called rapid transit communities such as Quincy that have MBTA transit service. The communities with commuter rail stations, their deadline is the end of this year, as is the case for communities classified as adjacent towns. So other communities that don't have train service in them but are adjacent to towns that do have until the end of this year. And then there's a smaller set of so-called very small towns that are also in the MBTA district. They have until the end of 2025.
Okay, that's good to know. Now, again, we chose Liz Shea as her community, the town of Abington. I'm going to use kind of a marathon-esque type, Boston Marathon-esque type of an analogy, but they're at Heartbreak Hill right now, and they see the finish line as next Monday night, a week from today, is when they had their town meeting. Let's talk about your community and how it embarked on this process, even how Judy was integrated into the process.
Okay, so as you said, it started in 2021, and it was kind of a slow rollout. I think everybody who wanted to was able to get technical assistance, which we did. Our first technical assistance came from OCPC, and they did some modeling for us. And by modeling, I mean they looked at different areas in the community and the parcels, the land parcels contained within them, and used the state's formula to see if those land areas would meet the criteria the state had set forth in these communities. Those were presented to the planning board. They looked at them meeting after meeting. This item actually stayed on our agenda for over a year, so they could talk about it at any time. The board decided to look closer to the train station to locate the entire district, and that's when Judy came on board, again, with more grant money from the state, and she's been fabulous. Her team's been fabulous. They modeled a couple of other areas for us. The board decided, since it met the criteria, that that's what we would go with, so at that point, the map was created. This was last fall. And then Judy started working on the zoning, and that draft zoning was done before the end of December, and I packaged everything up and sent it off to the state for pre-compliance. At this point in time, I have not heard back from them yet, but I have had the zoning reviewed by the Attorney General's office. They offered to do that. I think anybody else in the situation, if they have that offer, they should take advantage of it, only because it kind of helps you later on when everything from town meeting goes to the Attorney General's office. This has already been reviewed, and you have a chance of a quicker approval as long as all the other criteria gets met.
Who did you go through in regards to getting technical assistance? Was there a local agency or someone that you used?
Mass Housing Partnership was responsible, and the EOHLC, which is the Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities. They used to be DHCD.
God bless you.
All right, cause,
yeah, you squeezed
exactly,
that out.
Exactly. Which was the Department of Housing and Community Development. They changed names midstream, so that's added a little confusion, all this. And then in addition to that, the state last August dropped a new version of the law where you could add a mixed use. Abington has decided not to do that. The only other part of the MBTA community law that Abington did decide to use was the affordable housing component or the inclusionary zoning component. So 10% of our bylaw will require affordable housing units be built.
Knowing that you're somebody, not only being a town planner, but you're somebody who has to be, you know, you participate in the planning board meetings, and knowing that that's a task in itself when it comes to folks who want to come before you. And maybe they might want to do something residential. Then maybe they might want to do something that is, depending on how the zoning is in your community. How did this add to another layer to what you do for the town on a regular basis?
It was a pretty heavy lift. I'm
was
not
really?
Going to lie. It was. It's just that it's been a long process, right? Our by statute, our deadline is December of this year. In many respects, I'm glad we had the time. We were able to work out a lot of our kinks, and we're going, as you said, April 1st to town meeting. If it doesn't pass or there's an issue, we still have time to fix it. We can have a fall town meeting and fix it, which I'm, again, very grateful for, that we've started this process early enough that we're hopefully ahead of the curve here. And if we need to fix something, we can go back and fix it and still be compliant by the end of the year.
So I want to ask Judy, knowing that Abington is a community that the commuter rail goes through. How does the advice or the information you share with communities that seek out your services differ for the ones that are in a butter to a community that has the commuter rail? Is it different or is it the same?
So the main difference is that if you have a train station in your community, some percentage of that multifamily district has to be right around the train station. And that percentage varies from town to town based on how much developable land is in that area. If you're a so-called adjacent town, you don't have the train station location requirement, but you still have to identify what's considered an eligible location. So a downtown, a neighborhood activity center, places that are recognized in a community as places where people go for goods and services or whatever. There has to be some thought process to what constitutes an appropriate location for multifamily housing, but the train station piece goes away.
So I'd have to ask you, and that is that this Massachusetts, the communities law, I mean, is it cut and dry? Is it pretty clear? Or is there room for interpretation depending on the communities and what they want?
Well, the legislature adopted what I call an umbrella piece of legislation. It has a certain direction. It's, you have to have multifamily housing at least 15 units an acre. It has to be near public transportation or in an other eligible location. And then the legislature essentially delegated to Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities the challenge of writing guidelines so communities could essentially take that umbrella and put more detail into it. So it's that agency's responsibility to make sure communities comply. There have been a few changes in the guidelines based on issues that communities brought up. But for the most part, I think the guidelines are pretty clear. It's just that the approach to compliance might differ quite a bit from town to town, depending upon where there's appropriate areas for development.
What was it like working with Abington? What was some of the growing pains and some of the work that you did to create a zoning for this?
Well, by the time we got involved, there had been, as Liz said, a lot of discussion here. There had already been close to a year of conversation in Abington about potentially appropriate locations. You know, does it go near the train station? Does it go near the train station in Weymouth? You know, how does Union Point fit into all of this? And those are conversations that are kind of unique to some of the communities right here. But I think for the most part, the challenge for Abington has been what it is for a lot of communities. It's finding a location, one that makes sense, and then reaching the targets that they have to meet under the guidelines, which are more specific than the statute. And an example is that the guidelines also set a target for how much housing the district needs to be designed to accommodate. So that's not in the statute, but it's in the guidelines, because the guy was, again, left to a state agency to figure out, well, what's a reasonable way to say, yes, they comply. So towns also have what's called a zoned capacity target, which is when you add up how much could be built in this district under the zoning bylaw, how many units would you get? But I think, again, you know, one of the things that makes kind of the understanding and carrying out of the law a little bit of a challenge is that it isn't, to a developer, it's never just about zoning. You still have wetlands, you still have, wastewater, you still have all these other permitting requirements that you have to meet above and beyond zoning. So you may have a zoning district that says you can build 15 units an acre here, but the reality is that by the time the developer tries to do that, the other permitting requirements will supersede and change what actually can be built.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Abington Town Planner Liz Shea and Judy Barrett. She is the founding principal and managing director of Barrett Planning Group, LLC. And we're talking about the Massachusetts Communities Law and when it's going into effect. Again, as we've learned so far, that it varies, but there is definitely a deadline that all communities that are affected by the commuter rail service that have to be able to comply. I want to turn to you, Liz, and I think one of the things that I find impressive is that the planning board in your town actually, whenever it would meet, would make sure that the conversation was continuing with every agenda, just in case there was a new wrinkle, or maybe there was a concern by a resident, or maybe something that was realized with conversations, whether with Judy or other state officials.
Yes, I mean, that was very, very helpful for us, especially for the board members. They could, you know, if they talk to residents, they could bring that back to the board and, think more about what they wanted included in the zoning or not included in the zoning or what area they wanted to look at. Excuse me. So all of that was very, very helpful in constructing the plan, the map, and the zoning that will go forward at town meeting.
Very interesting. So I know that Abington, and I don't know if this is something that other communities have adopted or have, but I know that Abington actually has an affordable housing trust, and I don't know if that's helpful to the process. I know that Judy has met a few times with Abington's. I mean, Judy, how important is to have a second committee like that when it comes to housing and discussing it? Does it matter or not so much?
So it depends on the community. Some housing trusts are very involved in trying to promote development. Some of them are mainly administering funds to support development, say by a Habitat for Humanity project. Other housing trusts are in more of an advocacy role, so it varies by a lot by community. We have some communities where the housing trust kind of also wears an advocacy hat, and they're more involved in the discussions about the MBTA communities. In other towns, they just have a different role, and they're not at the table.
Do we have an idea as to what is the state hoping to glean as far as housing? I don't know whether you have any kind of round numbers for the state when it comes to creating housing or per community.
So each community, because of the way the MBTA communities guidelines work, do have what we call a zoned capacity number that they have to zone for. The law doesn't require development. It requires zoning. So you may zone for multifamily development, but whether it actually happens in your community depends on whether the zoning really makes sense to a developer. So you may, on paper, zone for 15 units an acre, but the rest of the requirements in the zoning may not be all that attractive to a developer. So the other point is, too, that developers will often prefer to be in places that have adequate utilities. Communities with sewer are more likely to see development than communities that don't have sewer. Mm. It's just reality. It's been that way all along. This law doesn't change that at all. You know, there is a housing crisis. I know people sometimes cringe when they hear that. But, you know, I'm an employer, and I can tell you it is a challenge hiring qualified people. I think the state is looking to communities to say the state puts money in, the state helps with infrastructure, the state does a lot of things to help facilitate development. But in the end, cities and towns have a role to play, too, and it's mainly in the area of development regulation. So I think they're just trying to get everybody sort of on the same page about the importance of providing for housing.
So I'm going to ask both of you the same question, and that is how important is it? Well, it's good to have these conversations and be putting everything together with your respective boards and committees, but how important is it for community engagement and for dissemination of information so that the community members best understand it? Now, I know that both of you were involved with trying to put together information to share with Abington. Liz, I mean, what was it like to try to make sure you're getting information out in case folks have questions so they will feel at least they're better informed, regardless if they're for or against, but at least they have, they're armed with the information to be able to, you know, stand up and say aye at town meeting or go, eh.
That's critical. We have had a public information session. We had a public hearing. The board will meet again before town meeting, and we've had very little attendance. But we did put that recording together, and that has gone on our website. That's gone out through social media. And I have received some positive feedback from that, that they thought it was very informative. There was a lot of great information in there. Which I'm hopeful more people are able to see and listen to and hear and maybe get their questions answered before they get to town meeting. We're happy to answer questions at town meeting, of course, but zoning can be a complicated issue. And if they can get the more information people have, the more knowledgeable they are on any topic before town meeting, the better off a town meeting goes, right?
Now, you've had a chance, Jude, to kind of see the process, and again, being involved in trying to put out information. How important is it to do at least follow in similar steps as a community like Abington?
So most of the communities we're working with have tried to do a lot of community engagement, and not different from Abington's experience. You sort of start out with public meetings and nobody shows up. The closer you get to town meeting, sometimes you start to see more people. You know, you're one of the communities I know of that's done a lot of outreach. Plymouth comes to mind as another community here on the South Shore that did public meetings, did a public hearing with the planning board, the select board, the finance committee, and throughout next week there are like 16 precinct meetings that the planning staff will be going to make sure everybody understands going into town meeting just what this thing is and why it is and so forth. So, you know, many communities have really sort of tried to make sure that at least their voters understand what's being proposed and why, and try to sort of make sure that misinformation doesn't sort of lead the way.
If you're just tuning in, we're close to wrapping up with Abington Town Planner Liz Shea and Judy Barrett with the Barrett Planning Group, LLC. I'm going to take a right turn on, down to a path that I think we only want to be on for a few moments, but I'm sure folks have paid attention to the news. What are the ramifications for a community if they decide that they do not want to adopt the MBTA Communities Law, similar to a Milton?
So the statute says that if communities don't comply, they sacrifice eligibility for three grant programs, at least one of which tends to be fairly important to some communities. It's what we used to call MassWorks. It's a program that pays for infrastructure improvements. But the statute also says that every community shall have this district. So the state government's interpretation is, regardless of how you feel about the grants, the law says you shall have this district. So Milton had approved a district by referendum that was overturned. When I say approved, it was a town meeting last fall. Voters decided in a referendum to overturn that, and the Attorney General's office is now taking Milton to court to try to force compliance. And we don't know where that's going. There's no expedited hearing on it that I know of at this point. So I think the earliest that they'll even be taking it up at the Supreme Court, which will be taking the case directly, I think the earliest for that is the fall.
As someone who's a consultant, I mean, how are you watching this process play out? Do you and some of the folks you work with have, like, you know, things that you say to communities in regards to a situation like this?
Well, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with the Milton case. I do a lot of zoning work. I've been in this field for a long time. When a law says you shall,
you shall.
And there are a lot of things communities are told they have to do. That's why you go to town meeting every year. You appropriate funds to do things that you shall do. So as a consultant, I would be irresponsible if I said, you don't have to do this. Therefore, what we're trying to get communities to focus on is planning, because that's ultimately the opportunity under this law, is that you get to plan for where you think it would make sense to do this. Some communities will say, well, we don't have any place that's appropriate. I've never worked in a town that doesn't have a place that's not appropriate. But you have to do some thinking about it. And it is possible to do. If you don't want to comply, then you may not comply, and, you know, we'll see what happens.
Suffer the consequences.
You know, that's up to the community. But, I mean, as a consultant, I'm not going to tell people you don't have to comply with a law that says you shall.
Liz, you got a week before town meeting takes place in your community. If there are any Abington residents that are tuned into the segment and they have any questions, I mean, at this late date, is it too late to either call your office or for them to be able to ask questions at town meeting, which will be in the middle high school auditorium come 7 o'clock next week?
7 o'clock next week.
Yay.
Exactly. It's been a long haul to get here. I'm just going to say that. It's never too late to ask questions. I invite everybody to email me, call me. I'm happy to answer any questions you have. I would rather have you have the facts, whether you agree with this or not. I would prefer that you have the correct information coming into town meeting and cast your vote based on that, not on what's on social media, not what you're reading about another community. Every community is different.
Yep.
In regards to the Milton piece, it makes me nervous about what will happen there. And right now, we have local control. We can decide where this is going. We can decide what our zoning says. I have no idea whether that'll be the case further down the road, what will happen. But there's always that specter in my head that could happen. I think Judy has done a marvelous job of writing the zoning. I think she's captured everything the board wanted. I think it's the best option for Abington at this point to stay compliant. I do actually have a board member who has said, you know what, we move forward, we stay compliant, but if we're not happy with it, we can always, you know, take that up afterwards, but that we need to stay compliant and move forward and, you know, adopt the zoning.
I will say that I've witnessed as someone who has watched the meetings, whether it's the affordable housing, the planning board, witnessed the informational piece that's put together that Judy Barrett and her group do a sensational job at putting the information together and fitting it to each community's needs, and it's common sense, so it's fantastic. I mean, my last question for both of you, and I ask this of most guests, is there something that we haven't mentioned, that we haven't talked about? You know, at least want to take a moment to, you know, share with the listeners. Judy?
I think if communities stop and think about it, people in communities stop and think about it, there are housing needs that many of our communities currently don't meet. And I'm not going to say it's their fault. I'm not going to say, that they've created this situation. I'm not going to say any of that. I'm just going to point out that everybody's aware of people with housing needs. And I think we have an opportunity to try to address some of those needs in a fairly calm way through this law. And that's what we should do as good community planners.
Makes sense. Liz?
I'm going to actually echo what Judy said, and I want people to think about maybe their kids who are in college and want to move back to Abington and can't afford to. Or if people have lived here their whole lives and they maybe are on a fixed income and can't afford to stay in their homes any longer and they would like to downsize. Our housing cycle is sort of stalled. People aren't moving and younger people can't buy, and that's true in every community. And I think this will help. I think, you know, creating housing along all over the South Shore will maybe help to alleviate some of that problem. I'm not saying it's a cure-all at all by any means, but it might help.
Judy, do you want to give out your information in case there is a prospective community that, not to pile up more work on your desk or on any of the other folks who work with you's desk, but if there is a community out there that might be starting the process or maybe somewhere in the middle of the process and may seek your services, you want to give them your website or something?
Sure. So people can go to our website, www.barrettplanningllc.com, and all of our contact information is there. I have a staff of 10 wonderful people, and we're all really busy with this. So if people want to contact us, that's probably the easiest way to find us.
Judy, Liz, I want to thank you both for coming in and sharing this fantastic information, and hopefully there's a community out there that has tuned in, and maybe it'll help them with their process. That'll do it for this segment of Monday Night Talk. We are going to step aside just for a moment. Fear not. We'll be back. Jerry Thornton will be on the other side. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Located in downtown Whitman, McWiggins Pub is a fashionable, upscale Irish sports pub with a lively bar and dining room. With all the class of a Boston pub, McWiggins serves a great pub menu featuring favorites like beer-battered fried pickles, Reuben sandwiches, shepherd's pie, bangers and mash, and meatloaf. And of course, they have Guinness on tap. McWiggins is a great place to eat, drink, and socialize with family and friends. With 8 flat-screen TVs, you'll always find yourself in the center of the action of your favorite team. And don't forget the patio at McWiggins right next door. They're located at 546 and 552 Washington Street in downtown Whitman.
Few make it big in motorsports, but the real reward for most is the joy of competition. I'm Miles Heger. The excitement and danger of motorsports are the reasons drivers love to race and why fans keep showing up. Join me and my guests each week as we discuss the local short tracks while also sharing opinions and insight on the national series. Tune in to Miles on Motorsports Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. here on 95.9 WATD.
Follow Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we return for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. And what a great way to kind of close off a fantastic show than to have the one and only Jerry Thornton from Barstool Sports joining us to talk a little New England Patriots, talk about what's been happening as far as the team, and also this little docuseries called The Dynasty. I think it was, if anything, it was more of a the hatchet job, but we can get into that in a few moments. Jerry, how are you doing?
I'm well, Kevin. I'm always even better after a nice weekend to talk to. To you, truly one of nature's noblemen. So thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
So I got to start with, you know, what we've, some of the flurry of moves that have happened since the end of the regular season and the postseason. No more Bill Belichick. Now it's part. Now it is the Gerard Mayo. It's the Mayo era. And we have a guy named Wolf who is the pseudo GM, but may not be the GM after the draft. And there's been a slew of signings, but not necessarily anything that will be welcomed by the New England Patriot fandom. And there's no more Mac Jones. He is now a Jaguar.
Yeah, the Belichick thing. Needless to say, I'm struggling with it. Still to this day. Yes, all good things must come to an end. But for years, people would ask me, I'd go do speaking engagements and come on shows like yours. And people would say, well, how's it going to end with Bill? And my typical answer was, he's going to figure out how to evolve beyond his corporeal form, become a glowing ball of pure energy, and then inhabit the body of another 20-year-old up-and-coming coach, and keep coaching the Patriots really until the sun goes nova. That was my plan. And instead it ended with, okay, I get it. Like, he went in to this season on the proverbial hot seat. Now, no one was disputing that, not even me. In fact, I was saying, good, bring it on. Here's his chance to prove himself. And you went 4-13. Yeah, a lot of those games were close. A lot of them were competitive. But just this team continued this maddening, probably 4 or 5 year run that they've had of finding ways to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory, like, or be in a position to win a game at the end and then just not do it with a fumble, a pick, you know, a receiver not being able to get his toes in bounds, you know, and ultimately someone's responsible for that. And when you're dealing with the guy who, more than any other public figure I've ever seen in my life, was willing to take all the responsibility for the bad stuff and never deflect any of it to anybody else. But then when the good things happen, would sort of find ways to, well, you know, it's the players, you need good players, whatever. Okay, so I think ultimately that was part of his undoing, is he just said, something bad happens, it's on me. And 4-13 was on him, even though there were other factors. So when it finally came, it's almost like when the Red Sox traded Nomar Garciaparra. Like, remember how like things were just sort of turning ugly for him in Boston? And as much as I loved him, and as much as I had like two kids' closets half filled with Nomar gear, I was relieved when he left so it wouldn't get worse. And Belichick, and I say this, it really hurts my heart to admit it, but you know, I just didn't want to see him enter the fat Vegas Elvis stage of his career, you know, like sweating through his Golvermae jumpsuit and throwing, you know, soaked sweat for, you know, scarves at middle-aged ladies and stuff. So I was kind of, in a way, relieved when he left, painful as it was.
Are you surprised, though, that he has not been, he was not able to find another NFL team to, you know, be on the sidelines and kind of replicate what he did here in New England and be kind of the pseudo GM, but yet he was still going to be the guy who was going to be, you know, on the sidelines and do what he normally does?
Yeah, Kevin, stunned beyond belief. I've always held that if, you know, people say, I did Kraft ought to fire Belichick for this or that. I always said, you know what, before he was done putting a period at the end of that, your fired sentence, Belichick would already be hired by somebody else. Mm. And it's crazy to me that Washington didn't do that. But I get it. Like, he's not going to accept less. He's not going to suddenly go work for some guy. Or, you know, Atlanta was a prime example where, you know, they've got a vice president of football operations whose name escapes me. It's not relevant. But I just kind of figured, okay, this guy has the ear of the owner. And he's not about to cede power, even to the greatest ever to do it.
Right.
He's never accomplished a bloody thing in his career that you can point to and say, there you go, this is why you got to keep me around and not him. But I kind of think, if I can make a Game of Thrones reference, I think he was like, you know, Littlefinger. Like, he had the ear of the king and wasn't about to give him any advice other than, oh, my liege, you do not want this man. He's not going to be good at what he does, whatever. And if you're Belichick at this point, are you really going to go answer to somebody else after everything you've done and have to take on some whole new system and listen to some GM who has never built a championship in his life when you've built, like, multiple? Having said that, the fact that nobody was willing to hire him is just astonishing to me. And I hopefully the rumors we're hearing are true, that one of the networks is going to scoop them up and have them sit there and do analysis, because he'll be brilliant. He's already won an Emmy doing that while he was coaching the Patriots. So right. I'd love to hear him talk and break down film and just be relaxed and be himself. But yeah, the fact that he's unemployed and this whole list of like utter failures in this league still have their jobs. I mean, what's his name from the Falcons that we beat in the Super Bowl in 2016? Dan Quinn.
Like
he's back in the league. Like what's going on? It makes no sense. But we know this.
Well, I think
whatever the factors are to hire people, it's not a meritocracy.
But I think he showed his worth being, you know, the defensive coordinator of Dallas and doing an admirable job. And I think with enough time that has passed, it was like, who is really worth bringing in to be your HC? And you look at a lot of the recycled names and individuals, and you go, well, let's give this guy another chance. Maybe he won't get to the Super Bowl and be up by 25 points and end up losing it, you know, in the closing minutes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would give another chance to the guy who's won 6 Super Bowls, but that's just me.
Yep.
You know, clearly, Kevin, if we've known anything about one another for the last 20 years, we've been pals. Objectivity is not really my strong suit when it comes to this team and this particular coach. But you know, 32 NFL owners feel different, and a lot of those guys are clearly just lucky spermers who never could have like amassed the wealth it takes to own a team on their own. They just inherited it. And just because you're rich doesn't mean you're not an imbecile.
So I was going to kind of talk Gerard Mayo, free agents. Sure. I think what I'm going to do now is let's see if we have enough time at the end and we can talk about that, because I kind of feel as though you've kind of already kind of lit the path for the dynasty. Anybody who has watched this, it was interesting how this was produced, how they went about telling the story. And there were times I felt for Bill, I almost felt as though he was hostage in this whole production, because they were firing, you know, questions at him about things that he had already responded to. You know, if you've attended the hundreds or watched the hundreds of press conferences when they ask him something point blank, he's not going to budge. Even if you hit him with a sledgehammer, he's not going to give you an answer. He's not going to change his ways when it comes to that. Give me your thoughts on the dynasty and what did it ultimately accomplish, other than telling the story of one of the greatest franchises of the National Football League?
Yeah, telling the story of one of the greatest franchises in the history of National Football League badly and slanted. Look, when the trailer first dropped, and I looked it up the other day, it was November 17th, and I wrote about it on Barstool, BarstoolSports.com. I read under the name Jerry Thornton. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe. I have bills to pay. and I said, okay, is it me? Like, I'm excited about this because I want to, you know, any new Patriots content I can get is all well and good, but is it me, or does this thing have a really grim tone to it? Like, even like the minute and 10-second trailer they first released really leaned heavily into the way it ended, the way it broke up. I was like, they're not going to do that for 10 episodes, are they? Well, it began well enough. I'm like, okay, cool. I've never seen that before. That's great footage. I never saw that angle of, say, Drew Bledsoe, like, you know, after the Mo Lewis hit, like, it's, oh man, that's really hard. But there's these, like, you know, behind the scenes interviews, and people are really being expansive. And okay, I'm liking this. And then it didn't take long to prove to me that my first instincts were right. It was so dark and weird. Like, I don't know. Call me crazy, but I remember there being some good times over 20 years and 9 trips to the Super Bowl and whatever. And they literally did this. This is when they lost me. And at that point, I was only hate watching it the rest of the way. They did, you know, a grievance session with Drew Bledsoe. I was a fan of Bledsoe, but he's they did 20 minutes about how salty he is about the fact that when he was healthy, they didn't start him. They didn't give him his job back. They gave it instead to this little nobody by the name of Tom Brady. And like how negative that was and how mean-spirited it was. Then they segue to Bill Parcells airing old grievances about the mid-90s and the Patriots and how they didn't draft the guy they wanted to draft. And then they literally showed two plays, an Adam Vinatieri field goal and an interception by Rodney Harrison. They said, and the Patriots won the next two Super Bowls. Then came Spygate. What? That's it? The 2003 and 2004 season got 10 seconds, if that. The greatest back-to-back seasons in the history of the NFL. They went 34-4 and won two Super Bowls.
Yep.
And it just, we're not going to talk about that. We're just going to get you straight into Spygate, which they did a whole episode on. And that's what, and you're right about Belichick. Like, he will be tight-lipped if you're asking about something he doesn't want to talk about. But if you want to get him to really expound on a topic, ask him a genuine football question. Ask him something about, like, the achievements, the things that he made, that he did, the things that his players accomplished, the moves that he made. And you'll get hours of, like, the most, like, articulate guy in the world. There was none of that. He looked like a tobacco executive on 60 Minutes. The entire time. I was like, what are they doing here? And a whole episode about Aaron Hernandez where they did that old narrative. The Boston Globe did this for years. Yes. It became a true crime podcast of that episode. And the way the Boston Globe has always portrayed that, you would have thought Belichick was an unindicted co-conspirator. Like, oh, everybody knew. No, nobody knew. No one knew what this is. They knew he was a weird guy. And came from a difficult past, but I missed the part where he sat down in his interviews at the Combine. So where do you see yourself in 5 years? Well, I'm really homicidal. So I imagine I'm going to kill someone execution style in a lot. Like nobody knew. And they pretend that Belichick should have known. It was just such an odd choice. And then at the end, they grudgingly gave him his due on the Super Bowl 53, the one against the Rams, where his game plan held the 11th highest scoring team in NFL history to that point to 3 points. And they gave him this credit, but even that was just kind of tonally weird. Like, okay, they're throwing him a bone, but the other 9.5 episodes have just been about what a terrible, mean-spirited war criminal he is. It was strange, Kevin. Do you agree with me? You feel the same way?
I do. And again, if folks are just tuning in, we're speaking with the great Jerry Thornton from BarstoolSports.com. We're talking about everything Patriots, and we're talking right now focusing on the dynasty. Did you have a chance to watch the docuseries? MondayNightTalk@gmail.com. Send me your thoughts, and maybe it'll make up fodder for another show. But yeah, I felt whether it was talking, you hit all the points that I was going to mention was Aaron Fernandez. Who cares? And even delving into why didn't Malcolm Butler play? We had to try to unearth something from that, or even when Tom Brady left, and having little retorts from Danny Amendola. Well, even a high school kid in Foxborough knows that you don't let Tom Brady leave. Like
Danny Amendola is he achieved Asante Samuel levels of bitterness.
Oh yeah,
like I never thought there'd be another Patriots player that would be that salty towards a guy who, by the way, signed him over the howling, angry, vehement objections of the Boston media to replace Wes Welker in 2013. And then Amendola got hurt in his first game. He missed 4 out of the next 6, I want to say. And Belichick was getting murdered in this town for that. Mm. And by the way, he signed you for good money, made you into a 2-time world champion. More importantly, just speaking personally, he brought you to a place where you could live in Rhode Island and meet former Miss Rhode Island and Miss Universe Olivia Culpo and date her. I would be pretty grateful to a gentleman who introduced me to a woman like that, and said I, you know, married one, of course, just in case the Irish Rose is listening to this. But look at, so that was weird. I can sum up the dynasty in saying that, and I wrote this in Barstool, so probably I plagiarized myself, but it would be like you get your high school yearbook, and instead of it being about like who was the valedictorian, who were the class officers, you know, prom king and queen, the sports teams, the chess club or whatever, instead it was about who puked and where they puked and when they puked and what they puked up, and they do a feature on the custodian who's got that green sawdust stuff, this clean up the puke. And you don't talk about the accomplishments. You just get into the barfing. And that's what they did. And I so appreciate some of the players who were in it coming out and basically disowning the thing. Rob Gronkowski was really angry on camera. But then he just gave an interview the other day where he just said, I owe everything to Belichick. Without him, this dynasty doesn't happen. I'm not in the position where I'm in. He's the greatest that's ever done it. Like, okay, if he said that in his interviews, it ended up on the editing room floor.
Right.
Rodney Harrison said that he gave us 6 hours of interviews, and all they had them do was drop F-bombs about, like, how we're going to, you know, during Spygate, where, you know, we're going to, you know, come after everybody, you know, we don't care what anyone thinks. He goes, that's all they used them. That was it. And Devin McCourty was talking to Harrison. Now, so you got the two best safeties from each half of the dynasty of the championship era. And they're both just saying, I can't believe the tone that this thing took. And Julian Edelman was, you know, added his voice to that too. So I'm glad my instincts weren't the alone. Like, everybody seems to feel the same way. So you say, who was it made for? It wasn't for Patriots fans, I can tell you that.
Do you feel that Jonathan and Robert Kraft's fingerprints are all over this, and that they wanted to control the narrative, and that they were basically there when they were talking about how to script this out and how to put this together, that they had a vision for the direction of this docuseries?
I honestly don't know, and I sincerely hope not. I like them. I like what they've done. I personally thank Mr. Kraft for saving my football team from moving to St. Louis. Like, we owe him everything. He was the one that had the wisdom to hire Belichick in the first place. But I like to think that they were as done dirty by this as everyone else, because otherwise, you know what it feels like? And I think this is a perfect apples to apples comparison. Remember in 2011 when the Red Sox collapsed and it was chicken and beer, and they let Terry Francona go? And I, to a person, Red Sox fans are like, okay, love Tito. It's time for him to go. He said time, they need a different voice in the clubhouse. Everyone parted on the most amicable terms possible. And then a week goes by, and then there was that hatchet piece in the Globe, which even then was owned by John Henry, that just made him out to be this, like, you know, the damaged, you know, two-faced, philandering pill addict. Whatever, it was a total hit job. And the result was more sympathy towards Francona and tons of animosity towards Red Sox and ownership, to the point where you didn't really want to root for them after that, that they would ever have done that. I have to think that the Krafts wouldn't be motivated to kick Bill on the way out the door, but also they would understand how that's going to be perceived by fans if they did, right? It's going to be a total, like, blowback. Mm-hmm. And, you saw the press conference where he said, you know, we're parting the ways, it's mutual or whatever. Like, that's what Belichick deserves between now and the time they break ground on the statue of him. I can't imagine they would be so unself-aware to do that. I certainly, that's certainly not the Robin and Jonathan Kraft that that I've known and that have been running this team. So I hope it was just, you know, more media coming after Belichick, which they've been doing since long before he ever got here. I will take that to my grave.
Again, we're speaking with the great Jerry Thornton from Barstool Sports. Jerry, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. I think that gives us enough time to kind of talk about the new era that we are entering.
Yeah.
Me personally, I know nothing about building a football team and how to do it from the ground up or, you know, but, you know, folks, if you listen to sports radio and you got two of those stations in the Boston area, it's doom and gloom. We have entered the dark era. And, you know, depending on how they finish up in free agency and who they draft and are they going to trade down, you know, we could be, we could be, 4-13 again for the next 2 or 3 years if things don't go right. Your assessment of what's gone on so far. And what have you watched, and what do you think of this team at this point? Is it way too early to say, you know, they've got the ingredients, we just have to see how they mix them?
Yeah, my first reaction that, what do I want? Instant gratification. Yep. When do I want it?
Now.
What do you think? Like I said, okay, free agency now. They've got $100 million to spend going into this. Yes, it's never the way we've done business, is to go and just throw a bunch of money at everybody, but we let the guy go who used to be the one who was disciplined. Like you know what, Kevin, it's like this. Mom's new boyfriend has moved in. Dad was always practical. He always gave you, like, sound gifts, socks and underwear. And if you got you a bike, it was a used bike because it's a better deal or whatever. I want Mom's new boyfriend to get my affection the old-fashioned way. Buy it. Just buy me shiny things. That's all I want. Well, clearly they're not going to do this. And for, you know, Belichick being so bad at a GM that they had to fire him, okay, that's your approach, but they bring in guys who are doing exactly the way he would have done it.
Right
to the point where I love the fact that they've re-signed all their pending free agents. I wrote a list of the 9 guys I'd most want to keep. They've signed the top 5 plus Josh Uche, who I only had about 7th. Okay, so this is all a validation of GM Bill. They're doing things exactly the way he would have. I just think right now they still need an influx of talent. I think they've tried, but, you know, they haven't made the big splashy move. That's kind of what I want. So we'll see what's going on with that. I like them bringing in Jacoby Brissett because he's solid. We like him here. We know he's a gamer. We'll never forget week 4 in 2016 when Brady was suspended and Jimmy Garoppolo was hurt. He played an entire game and then had to get surgery on his throwing hand right afterwards. And he cemented his position as a guy to be respected at that point, you know, and he was just a rookie then. So you bring him in, you draft one of the top 3 quarterbacks, likely either Jaden Daniels from LSU or Drake May from UNC. And wait, Kentucky? Yeah.
No, you're right.
Yeah, UNC, okay. I'm sorry, the college basketball is like all in my head as well. No one you bring in has to start right away and you can build around them. But the bottom line in all this is we're in this for the long haul, meaning expect below averageness, if that's a word that I'm making up on the fly, for a
the South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. 95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.